I am an alumnus of the great school that employs Dr. Pritchett at present, the Patrick Henry University. But I studied under one of his predecessors, Hugh Axton. Hugh Axton? The attractive young woman gasped. But you couldn't have Senor D'Anconia. You're not old enough. I thought he was one of those great names of the last century. Perhaps in spirit, madam, not in fact. But I thought he died years ago. Why, no, he's still alive. Then why don't we ever hear about him any more? He retired 9 years ago. Isn't it odd? When a politician or a movie star retires, we read front-page stories about it. But when a philosopher retires, people do not even notice it. They do, eventually. A young man said, astonished, I thought Hugh Axton was one of those classics that nobody studied anymore except in histories of philosophy. I read an article recently which referred to him as the last of the great advocates of reason. Just what did Hugh Axton teach? Asked the earnest matron. Francisco answered, He taught that everything is something. Your loyalty to your teacher is laudable, Senor D'Anconia, said Dr. Pritchett dryly. May we take it that you are an example of the practical results of his teaching? I am. James Taggart had approached the group and was waiting to be noticed. Hello, Francisco. Good evening, James. What a wonderful coincidence seeing you here. I've been very anxious to speak to you. That's new. You haven't always been. Now you're choking, just like in the old days. Taggart was moving slowly, as if casually, away from the group, hoping to draw Francisco after him. You know that there's not a person in this room who wouldn't love to talk to you. Really? I'd be inclined to suspect the opposite. Francisco had followed obediently, but stopped within hearing distance of the others. I have tried in every possible way to get in touch with you, said Taggart, but circumstances didn't permit me to succeed. Are you trying to hide from me the fact that I refused to see you? Well, that is, I mean, why did you refuse? I couldn't imagine what you wanted to speak to me about. The San Sebastian mines, of course. Taggart's voice rose a little. Why, what about them? But, now look, Francisco, this is serious. It's a disaster, an unprecedented disaster, and nobody can make any sense out of it. I don't know what to think. I don't understand it at all. I have a right to know. A right? Aren't you being old-fashioned, James? But what is it you want to know? Well, first of all, that nationalization. What are you going to do about it? Nothing. Nothing? But surely you don't want me to do anything about it. My mines and your railroad were seized by the will of the people. You wouldn't want me to oppose the will of the people, would you? Francisco, this is not a laughing matter. I never thought it was. I'm entitled to an explanation. You owe your stockholders an account of the whole disgraceful affair. Why did you pick a worthless mine? Why did you waste all those millions? What sort of rotten swindle was it? Francisco stood looking at him in polite astonishment. Why, James, he said, I thought you would approve of it.
Approve?
I thought you would consider the San Sebastian mines as the practical realization of an ideal of the highest moral order. Remembering that you and I have disagreed so often in the past, I thought you would be gratified to see me acting in accordance with your principles.
What are you talking about?
Francisco shook his head regretfully. I don't know why you should call my behavior rotten. I thought you would recognize it as an honest effort to practice what the whole world is preaching. Doesn't everyone believe that it is evil to be selfish? I was totally selfless in regard to the San Sebastian project. Isn't it evil to pursue a personal interest? I had no personal interest in it whatever. Isn't it evil to work for profit? I did not work for profit. I took a loss. Doesn't everyone agree that the purpose and justification of an industrial enterprise are not production, but the livelihood of its employees? The San Sebastian mines were the most eminently successful venture in industrial history. They produced no copper, but they provided a livelihood for thousands of men who could not have achieved in a lifetime the equivalent of what they got for one day's work, which they could not do. Isn't it generally agreed that an owner is a parasite and an exploiter, that it is the employees who do all the work and make the product possible? I did not exploit anyone. I did not burden the San Sebastian mines with my useless presence. I left them in the hands of the men who count. I did not pass judgment on the value of that property. I turned it over to a mining specialist. He was not a very good specialist, but he needed the job very badly. Isn't it generally conceded that when you hire a man for a job, it is his need that counts, not his ability? Doesn't everyone believe that in order to get the goods, all you have to do is need them? I've carried out every moral precept of our age. I expected gratitude and a citation of honor. I do not understand why I'm being damned. In the silence of those who had listened, the sole comment was the shrill, sudden giggle of Betty Pope. She had understood nothing, but she saw the look of helpless fury on James Taggart's face. People were looking at Taggart, expecting an answer. They were indifferent to the issue. They were merely amused by the spectacle of someone's embarrassment. Taggart achieved a patronizing smile. "You don't expect me to take this seriously?" he asked. "There was a time," Francisco answered, "when I did not believe that anyone could take it seriously. I was wrong."
"This is outrageous!" Taggart's voice started to rise. "It's perfectly outrageous to treat your public responsibilities with such thoughtless levity."
He turned to hurry away. Francisco shrugged, spreading his hands. "You see, I didn't think you wanted to speak to me." Reardon stood alone far at the other end of the room. Philip noticed him, approached, and waved to Lillian, calling her over. "Lillian, I don't think that Henry is having a good time," he said, smiling. One could not tell whether the mockery of his smile was directed at Lillian or at Reardon. "Can't we do something about it?" "Oh, nonsense," said Reardon.
"I wish I knew what to do about it, Philip," said Lillian. "I've always wished Henry would learn to relax. He's so grimly serious about everything. He's such a rigid Puritan. I've always wanted to see him drunk, just once. But I've given up.
What would you suggest?"
"Oh, I don't know. But he shouldn't be standing around all by himself." "Drop it," said Reardon. While thinking dimly that he did not want to hurt their feelings, he could not prevent himself from adding, "You don't know how hard I've tried to be left standing all by myself."
"There, you see?"
Lillian smiled at Philip.
"To enjoy life and people is not so simple as pouring a ton of steel. Intellectual pursuits are not learned in the marketplace."
Philip chuckled. "It's not intellectual pursuits I'm worried about. How sure are you about that Puritan stuff, Lillian? If I were you, I wouldn't leave him free to look around. There are too many beautiful women here tonight."
"Henry entertaining thoughts of infidelity? You flatter him, Philip. You overestimate his courage."
She smiled at Reardon coldly for a brief, stressed moment, then moved away. Reardon looked at his brother. "What in hell do you think you're doing? Oh, stop playing the Puritan. Can't you take a joke?" Moving aimlessly through the crowd, Dagny wondered why she had accepted the invitation to this party. The answer astonished her. It was because she had wanted to see Hank Reardon. Watching him in the crowd, she realized the contrast for the first time. The faces of the others looked like aggregates of interchangeable features, every face oozing to blend into the anonymity of resembling all, and all looking as if they were melting. Reardon's face, with the sharp planes, the pale blue eyes, the ash-blonde hair, had the firmness of ice. The uncompromising clarity of its lines made it look, among the others, as if he were moving through a fog, hit by a ray of light. Her eyes kept returning to him involuntarily. She never caught him glancing in her direction. She could not believe that he was avoiding her intentionally. There could be no possible reason for it. Yet she felt certain that he was. She wanted to approach him and convince herself that she was mistaken. Something stopped her. She could not understand her own reluctance. Reardon bore patiently a conversation with his mother and two ladies whom she wished him to entertain with stories of his youth and his struggle. He complied, telling himself that she was proud of him in her own way. But he felt as if something in her manner kept suggesting that she had nursed him through his struggle and that she was the source of his success. He was glad when she let him go. Then he escaped once more to the recess of the window. He stood there for a while, leaning on a sense of privacy as if it were a physical support. Mr. Reardon, said a strangely quiet voice beside him. Permit me to introduce myself. My name is Dunconia.